Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory 95. Got a great episode today with Dart Adams. Tried to get him going live last week. Didn't quite work, so we circled back over the weekend, recorded on Zoom. We're bringing it to you here today. Awesome conversation about the Celtics, their preseason so far, 3 games in the books. They're looking good. They're looking fluid. They're standing together. Not too many issues stemming from that first day of camp where there was all this uncertainty and questioning and confusion, frankly, was the word of the day, over the Ime Udoka suspension. They've rallied around Joe Mazzulla like they said they were gonna, and things look good so far, but we'll learn about this group once things go bad. And that's gonna really tell us how the leadership structure is built and whether it's sustainable for this season. Grant Williams said as much over the past week or two here at camp. So getting into the Celtics, he has a new book out, Dart does. Instead We Became Evil, the story of Sleeman, who is a Danish rapper, former Danish rapper, I believe he's no longer making music, who started his life as a Palestinian refugee, immigrant rather, ends up in Denmark, gets into gang life, and of course this stems from some issues at home. His father tried to kill his mom and sister. Just a real blood-soaked story and a traumatic life that ended up working out successfully for him when he was able to get out of gang life and start making music. It's just a nice, succinct read, a pretty powerful story, and I kind of asked Dart, for an American audience who isn't as familiar with this guy, why it was important to bring this to the U.S. to English, kind of an adaptation of what was originally a book in Danish. So that's on deck. We talk a little bit about the Ime saga, though I'm pretty much ready to put that one to rest until we have anything more substantial. Or a substantive, rather. And of course, Dome Theory, brought to you by a couple great sponsors here, com.com/garden. Of course, show some love to the Garden Report by trying that out. Get 40% off a premium subscription. That's sleep sounds, meditation, yoga. Calm of the Day is something Joe Sway loves over there. So go check that out. Stuff for your mental health, sleep. I love the sleep sounds, of course. The rain, pretty much use something like that every night. I think you could even get like a fan sound over there too if you wanted. I know people love that. And of course, you're helping out the Garden Report. AthleticGreens.com/garden gets you 5 free travel packs of their powder with vitamins, minerals, adaptogens, and more. Probiotics, immune-boosting vitamin D, especially important this time of year. So you try to keep feeling good through this weather. And who else? BetOnline.ag. Football is back. We're 5 weeks in now? Yeah. Patriots 2-3. They cover this week with a dominating win over the Lions. And BetOnline remains your number one source for all your football betting needs this season. Not to mention basketball back in a week from today as we record this. You'll always find the best football odds. Latest football odds, rather. Team matchup info, player news, game trends, and more at BetOnline. Their great website makes it easy to toggle between MLB, playoffs going on, MMA, tennis, boxing, even golf. And of course, all your sports wagering information is on BetOnline, along with live betting, free contests, live scores, and giveaways all season long. Head to betonline.ag to join and receive your 50% welcome bonus with your first deposit. Just use the promo code CLNS50 to receive your rewards. That's CLNS50. 50% back, 100 bucks gets you 50 to play with, and that is betonline.ag where the game starts. Here is episode 95 of Dome Theory with Dart Adams. Go get it. Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher. Reviews and rates on iTunes help as well. And here's Dart. Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory 95. It's a beautiful day out here in Boston, Massachusetts, and we have Boston's own Dart Adams joining us. Good to have you, Dart. We're going to talk some Celtics. We're going to talk about your book with Sleeman, Instead We Became Evil. Here we go. Good looking cover, hard cover. I'm about halfway through it. Wish I could have finished it off before we talked about it here, but we'll get to that after our Celtics chat here. Preseason is rolling along, and the Celtics look pretty good, Dart. I'm liking the Malcolm Brogdon edition. I love the two preseason games so far. Super entertaining product. The offense is flying around, and you're as big of a preseason fan as anyone out there following all the action through the first couple of games here. Where you want to start? Like, everything looks good. The offense, the defense is stable. Joe Mazzulla, I'm sure we'll see what he's made of in time, but his imprint seems to be working well so far with this group. And even without Robert Williams, they're still playing defense at a pretty high level.
Yeah, I just feel like there were a lot of people coming into the season that felt that without Ime Udoka, the team was going to lose a lot of its edge and its focus. And I feel the opposite. I think that after the Celtics lost in the finals, after going up 2-1, after going through the whole revenge tour, that they were very focused on coming back and winning a championship this year. And thinking that Ime Udoka is going to be the thing that holds them back when he's not, you know, sitting on the bench anymore, I think is that's not the way to look at these things. It's a veteran team, for one. I mean, if you go back and look at Jaylen Brown has been to the finals, Eastern Conference finals multiple times. He has deep playoff runs. He's been in the playoffs. He's played big minutes in the playoffs going back to his rookie year in 2016. And when we had Jason Tatum come in, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown were two of the biggest reasons why the Celtics were 6 minutes from going to the 2018 NBA Finals. So when you look at the ups and the downs that they've had, you know, 2019 when Kyrie Irving, you know, tanked everything, like he threw that second round. He did. I feel like this team is so focused and so poised and is battle tested and already knew what to do. And they have this internal leadership core of, you know, Marcus Smart, who won the Defensive Player of the Year last year. Jason Tatum, who's become more of a vocal leader. Jaylen Brown, who's become more aggressive as of late. I think things turned around for him after all the trade rumors and everything else. He realized that if people saw him as somebody who was a legitimate choice to bring in a talent like KD to Boston, then he realizes, hey, I need to act like it, because last year they didn't have me as an all-star because our team record was so, you know, disappointing that they didn't want to have two guys from the Celtics in the all-star game. Instead, they put in the younger Ball brother. And like, I just feel like this team is already focused. They already know what they want to do. And they just wanted to come out the gates early. And if anything, I think that the way that they're playing exemplifies the fact that the coaching staff and the front office, especially Brad, knew that Malcolm Brogdon would be a perfect plug-in. Because when we're Celtics fans and we look at the other players in the league, you know, who are either in free agency or the people that are up for trades or what have you that can move, we don't look at the league as just like players. We look at them in two tiers. One, people that play like Celtics, and two, guys that would help this team, you know? And I think Malcolm Brogdon exemplified somebody who played like a Celtic. The way Boston Celtics basketball is supposed to be played is that the ball moves and everybody on the court is dangerous, you know? So that's the beauty of Celtics basketball. That's the beauty of preseason so far. They have 80-something assists on the first two games already.
41, you know, in the first one was a ridiculous total.
Yes, and Malcolm Brogdon has 18 of those, and he has 9 in each game. And he's not playing the full game, you know? So, like, that just goes to show you how, like, the Celtics, the ball movement is going. And, like, I know a lot of people were disappointed with the fourth quarter last game, but as far as I was concerned, we saw everything we needed to see. The thing was, we need to figure out who else should be on the roster. So even if they drop the fourth quarter and drop that game, it doesn't matter, because those guys needed to get minutes. We already know what we have. That's why in this next game, it's going to be a lot about seeing what we have in The new guy we brought in from
Blake Griffin.
Blake Griffin, a new guy that we brought in from Brooklyn. From
Nets, yeah.
Like, because we want to know, Blake Griffin was put in a bad position by the coaching staff in Brooklyn when they had him out on the perimeter trying to guard JB in the playoffs. Like, that was bad coaching. You're going to put that man out on an island with JB there, a wing? Like, that was stupid. It just goes to day where it shows you that the coaching staff there was just inept and grasping at straws, right? But I feel like what he's going to do, he's a passer, he's a rebounder, he can stretch the floor, and he can play in the post, you know, and he shares the ball. Like, I think he's going to be a great locker room presence. I think he's going to be a good anchor for those guys. And I think that the Celtics will try to figure it out by committee until Robert Williams comes back. But I feel that when Robert Williams and Gallo comes back, I think the Celtics will already be good in the season going forward. I think they'll be better than a lot of people anticipate. But I think they'll go to a whole nother level when we get Robert Williams and Gallo back in the rotation and they get in the playing shape. I'd rather this team, I don't mind the injuries early. I'd rather this team be forming into shape in February and March going into April, as opposed to that's when the injuries start happening coming into the playoffs. So I'll take it the way it goes. I'll take it the way it is right now.
Yeah. And that's pretty much what happened last year. And that's the only thing they have to figure out, I feel like, right now, is that big man situation. Horford, You don't want him playing 35, 38 minutes a game to start out. And that's what he had to do last year when Rob was hurt down the stretch. And he was capable of it. He looks great, by the way. I feel like he's in better shape this year than even last year. And so he's willing and able to shoulder a bigger load there. But who's going to step up alongside him? Luke Kornet gets hurt, and they were excited about him. He's out a couple weeks now. Not even going to get
that. I don't get. A lot of people are high on Kornet. I've never been high on Kornet. I think he's just a warm body myself. He does some things that are, I think he does some things that are intriguing, but I just don't think he's reliable. I'm higher on Mofondo Cabangele.
Yeah, I'm excited about him too.
Yeah, I'm much higher on him. I'm hoping that he can be a lot more. What's the word I'm looking for?
Reliable,
consistent, and reliable.
Consistent
and reliable, because you know when he was put in the game late, you know he was kind of out of He wasn't like his rhythm was off, you know.
He shot a three off the backboard.
Yeah, he shot two threes, which was really weird. He got actually, if you saw the game, when he came back after shooting a three and went to a timeout, the guys on the bench let him have it.
Yeah,
after shooting that three, and they were like joking, but you didn't need to shoot that. Like, that was not the shot to take. I don't care if it was open.
I think Blake especially was like, really? And Fiondu was like, what? And then they were just messing with him. But yeah. And they're working with these guys, especially Fiondu. I saw Jalen doing some pick and roll action with him at practice. I think Jared Weiss wrote about that today. And I even see him coaching him on the sidelines. That's a guy that some of the stars in this team are investing in for sure. And that's what excites me most, I think. You know, they look good on the court. It's preseason. We'll see. But off the court, Jalen and Jason sound like leaders to me right now. And you throw it back a year ago, Ime's trying to do this captain thing. He's saying we're going to have two captains, and Smart's like, oh, we don't need captains. And Jason kind of follows his lead, and Jalen nominates Horford. No one was really excited about that idea. It felt like whether it was just a concept or the fact that they were trying to assign leaders, and everybody kind of felt like they were a leader. I still don't really know what happened there. Ime ended up saying that that just went away with COVID, and they had to figure out rotations and stuff like that. That sort of became his line of why they didn't do captains. But anyway, a year later, Jason, I think, has a stronger voice. Al talked about that a couple weeks ago, how he became like a louder, more vocal voice into the playoffs, getting into guys, challenging guys. I think Jalen expressed that more directly in the postseason, that he was trying to step up in that capacity. And I thought he did a good job with it. And even through these early weeks of the training camp, in a position where, you know, Joe Mazzulla is taking over as head coach here, and he says he's going to lean on these guys to be leaders, I wasn't sure how willing they were going to be to step into that and have it be functional between the different guys you mentioned at the top of the team there. But for the first time ever, if I'm looking back at last year, Ime, to me, was the voice of the team and the guy that was challenging people and raising them up when they were low and, you know, bringing them back down to earth when they were high. Now I kind of hear that same thing out of Jalen and Jason. For the first time ever, this to me sounds like their team. Like they definitively sound like the voices of this team at the top.
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened that led to this has to do with the fact that they started out so slow last season. You know, they were a mediocre team. You know, they had some really bad tendencies early on that led to them losing a lot of games that they should have won, a lot of close games, but also had the fact that had a lot to do with the fact that they just didn't have the proper personnel to be able to execute what Ime was preaching. You know, Ime wanted to instill these type of things. The coaching staff wanted to do these type of things. We want to be this type of team. But the players they had on that roster did not allow them to do that. They just didn't. And it frustrated the guys at the top to the point where, as you well know, you know, there were people in the media, what's up, Perk, that went on national programs and said that they needed to break up the Jays because they're not playing together. They don't want to play together. And, of course, you had Marcus Smart, who is a leader and the heart of this team in every way, shape, or form, who did something that probably on most teams would have been a point, something that the team could never return from, saying these guys don't want to pass or they don't want to do X, Y, and Z. Marcus Smart can do that on this team. And you see what happened, right? Things got addressed. Things got squashed. Immediate action was made. So the team was on an upward tick before they made the necessary roster moves to bring in Derek White, you know, get rid of Enos, which, good Lord, needed to happen sooner.
Oh, my. Do you see what he said with the Ime suspension, by the way? I mean, that revealed as much about his character as anything else. And I gave him the benefit of the doubt at first with all the stuff he was doing.
I wanted that man gone as soon as humanly possible. He could get scored on by a trash can. He's horrible.
But talk about another thing early last year. It's November, right? I'm out in Vegas. I was off for a couple of days, but I was still kind of following along with the pressers and everything. And you have Enos saying, this might have actually just been to a reporter or something, that, oh, me and Ime had a talk and, you know, I had to make sure that my views off the court weren't going into my playing time. And then Ime was all of a sudden in this weird position where he had to play him more for a couple of games to kind of, you know, quell that storm.
I mean, it was also a thing of, does anybody want this asshole?
Yeah.
You know, and can he rebound? Sure. Can he score? Occasionally. Can he defend? No. So ultimately, he's a net zero. He's a garbage man, ultimately. And he was just on the roster, just making things awkward, you know, for the team, you know, for the franchise. And, you know, the second the Boston Celtics had the opportunity to jettison him, they did. And what happened? Addition by subtraction. And one player that I was really, sad about going was Richardson. But, you know, look at what happened when he was gone, you know? So it's like sometimes I was like, if there was one player we could have held on to, I wish it was Richardson. But other than that, you know, the team got so much better. The rotation got so much tighter. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that Robert Williams stepped up as an elite defender. And he kind of anchored that defense along with Marcus Smart. Because one of the beautiful things about Boston Celtics basketball, yeah, we share the ball on offense and we move. But moving after a miss, taking the ball after a made basket and running, getting into transition. These are ways to make easy baskets. These are ways to frustrate the other team. These are ways to make a lead balloon from 6 to 12 to 18. And the three-pointer. When you're shooting three-pointers in transition, when the ball's moving, it's just like when you play football. If that other team's always on defense and the offense is never on the field, you're going to kill these guys. You're just going to bury them. And that's what the Celtics were doing. And I'm sure you remember, there were times when the Celtics got hot after they made the transition and got the new lineup and everything else, and, you know, everything's clicking, where the Celtics were beating people by 20 points regularly in away games. Like, that was a shock to the rest of the league. I think partly because that's what they kind of expected the Celtics to do early, and they got it late. But I expect the Celtics, when they get everybody back, to return to that form.
Yeah.
So I think
Brogdon adds to that group now too. And that's probably the second most exciting thing about preseason for me, is how smoothly he's fitting in, how naturally he's making plays for these guys. And my favorite moment of the preseason so far is Tatum's kind of struggling early in that Toronto game. He goes 0-for-7 from three, has one of his bad shooting games that he can have sometimes. And there's a fast break at the end. Brogdon, I think, got a steal, got out, had an open lane to the basket, and just kind of threw it back to Tatum, let him have an easy dunk. And then a couple more baskets around the rim followed for Tatum. And that got Tatum going, and he ends 6-for-16. Not his best night ever, but ends up being a solid night for him. And who's feeding him the ball most of the night? Who's feeding Hauser for almost all of his baskets? It's Malcolm Brogdon off the bench.
And another thing about that is that, one, he had the awareness, the court presence, and the game presence to know that I need to feed this guy who's running, right? And also, this might get him started. That's how Malcolm Brogdon is thinking. So he gives him that basket. He scores the easy basket. Then that starts him hot. But the thing is that on the other end, he was playing defense. He already had about 7, 8, 9 rebounds, you know? He had a double-double early, you know? So even though the ball wasn't going in for him, he was doing other things. And that's the beauty of having two-way players. When you're elite players, the two top guys on your team are two-way guys that will give you buckets on the other end and then stop you and then initiate transition going forward. And the Boston Celtics are a scary transition team because Marcus Smart will run it down your throat. Then you got wings in the Jays. And then you got Al if Al's out there. Everybody is looking to get somebody the ball and looking to score, you know?
Yeah, they have good outlet passers too. Al, Smart.
Yes, like having good outlet passers, even when you're going to the hoop and trying to score, you're aware of who's in the corner or who might have a better shot if someone closes on you. If you have three men on you, wham, there's a three in the corner, you know? And you have people to rebound and box out. So the Boston Celtics are clicking on all cylinders in preseason, even though like the record doesn't really show it. But if you actually know basketball, you know that the second games ended after the third quarter when the starters left. And those last 8 minutes that they had Broderick and Jason and Jackson in
Justin
there.
Justin
Jackson and Broderick in there, Broderick Thomas in there. That was to get those guys minutes to see what they can do on the floor, right? And I think something we haven't talked about is, like, I think the person who's in limbo more than anybody in this whole process might be Peyton Pritchard, you know, because Peyton Pritchard he can knock down shots. He's proven he's tough. He'll drive to the hole. He was the primary scorer in that fourth quarter, but Peyton Pritchard's the odd man out. Even though he gives effort on defense strictly because of size and the fact that there are other people on the court that do what he does. Like, if Hauser turns out to be a sniper, look at how big Hauser is.
Yeah.
Look at how Hauser's size, all the things Hauser can do. That turns Peyton Pritchard into, you know, value, you know? So it's interesting because a lot of people are pulling for Peyton. I think Peyton was excellent last year. But the thing is that with holes in our team, you know, for the immediate right now, going into the trade deadline, I can see Peyton could be, you know, moved for something, you know, if it comes down to that, because it depends on when Gallo comes back too, because you're going to have Gallo and Hauser, and you already have Derek White coming off the bench or starting. You can change Brogdon for White coming off the bench or starting. That is mind blowing.
Yeah.
There are so many possibilities with this lineup. And of course, without Rob, I really hope Cap'n Galladay turns into like the defensive guy, the lob threat, you know. He could be so dangerous on a team full of shooters and guys that you have to occupy yourself with. Like,
isn't that something? I mean, this team's got a couple holes, as you said. They got a couple injuries. I think we were all excited about what they were going to look like, but them looking this good with all those holes, with all those injuries, makes you think when they get all these guys back at some point, this could be the prohibitive favorite in the league. due to all but, that interchangeability and due to all the top tier talent at the top.
But I mean, think about how they played when key guys were missing last year. You know, they won big games, even on the road, missing a major guy that people thought that was going to affect their game. But the Boston Celtics came out and played Boston Celtics basketball. And I think that, to me, the bigger question is, you know, like, I know a lot of people think that Joe Mazzulla isn't really up to the task at age 34, you know, not having like an NBA job before. But Joe Mazzulla's been on this staff and been on this bench through some, you know, interesting times. He was, you know, coaching for the Maine Celtics before. So he's 16, been on 17, this staff.
Yeah,
he's been on this staff. He's been around. He knows the direction of this team. He knows what they're trying to do. You know, he's worked with the players directly. Even if Ime's been over there, Joe was the guy working people out and on the bench and running around with people doing drills and stuff like that. So these players trust this staff already. So I know a lot of people from the outside have the feeling that Ime leaving is like this big drop off. But I kind of feel like it's one of those things where, you know, the class, you're in a martial arts dojo, the class is running or whatever. And then like Sifu leaves the class and he's like, you already know what to do, you know?
And that's the key. There's continuity. Yeah. You know, Joe comes in 1920. He's probably one of the player development guys at that point in the bubble. You know, he transfers over that next year, that weird year, 2021. And then he joins Ime's staff last year. But he's on the back of the bench. And so you got all these other assistants here, Damon Stoudemire, you got Ben Sullivan, you have a number of different coaches. Will Hardy leaves, which kind of stunk the timing of that, but he ends up in position to take over this bench, and it's awkward, right? See, he's a Stevens hire. You have this whole bench of Udoka guys. No one really knows what's happening with Ime now. Seems like he might never be back as coach here. So long term, I think there's a question there of what this bench looks like beyond this year. But in terms of immediate, you learn that Ime is not going to be here for the season a week before training camp. It did seem like these guys were pretty comfortable with someone they all have fairly good relationships with stepping into that role. He was pretty involved tactically late in the playoffs is what I heard, especially in that Miami series. He was kind of on the front line scouting and all that. So it's a comfortable change, right? It's not bringing in Frank Vogel or whoever to form a whole new staff and a whole new system a week before the season. They're pretty much going to do the same things. Maybe he adds his own wrinkles to it. Maybe the players suggest some things, but it makes it a lot more smooth. And we see it on the floor, right? Like they are just seamless right now, defensively and offensively, even though they do have to adjust some things for Rob and other guys not being out there.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like nationally, people know nothing about how the Boston Celtics organization operates. So to them, it's all on that one guy, right? He's the reason why everything turned around. And it's not the fact that the staff already had an idea of what to do and a direction to go. And Ime just brought in his personal philosophy. But now that it's been instilled and they had such, you know, success already, we want to do more of that. And we want to expound on that. And that mission's already, that card's already been filled out. We're already on it. I think the question is, you know, what will Joe Mazzulla do, you know, with, you know, out of bounds plays and trying to come up with adjustments, you know, on the fly and things like that. He's not a known commodity. He's not a proven guy in that respect.
Well, you know, my two questions on that front are, I think that first one, adjustments. Number two, and this was a big deal early when they got Brogdon and they've kind of quelled it since, but there will be games, I think, where you have all these different players involved. And yeah, Tatum and Brown are going to be on the floor all the time. You have all these guards. You mentioned Pritchard. He's probably the odd man out there. You have White. He might be hot on a night. You might have Brogdon hot one night. If you go back to game one of the finals, Ime made that decision to sit down smart in the fourth quarter and they roll with Pritchard and White and they blow the doors off the Warriors. And then Smart comes in late after that. Mm-hmm. Those kind of decisions on this roster, I think, are going to be the tough ones for Joe. Like the way guys react to being on and off the floor in certain situations on a team like this, where there's a lot of capable bodies.
I feel like going into this season that I think that the players have kind of already realized that that is going to be a possibility. And I think that they're prepared for it because in previous seasons that some of these guys were around, they know what happened when there were rotation issues and stuff like that. People in terms of playing time and who was on the court when and how that turned out for the team. And they don't even want to go down that road, yeah. You know, but, you know, there were extenuating circumstances in those situations, you know, having to do with trade rumors and people in free agency and things of that nature. And I also think that, like, there are up and down years for the Boston Celtics. And this is, I just don't feel like this particular thing that started in the beginning of the season, you know, the Ime Udoka situation is going to be one of those things that ends up, you know, deciding what happens with the Boston Celtics and messing up their chances of winning, you know, internal things dealing with the team. I think in previous years where we had stuff like, you know, is Kyrie going to sign with the team? You know, are we all going to be traded for AD in the off chance that he becomes available? You know, Those things were looming over the team and they actually sunk previous teams. The 2019 team was trash largely because of outside factors. You know, guys wanting to leave and go into free agency and get their money because they know they're never going to get the chance to start if this guy comes back. People who want to leave because they don't want to come back if this guy comes back, you know? So we're looking at Al, we're looking at Terry, you know, we're looking at like some of the veteran guys, you know, that were just like journeymen, Morris. Like, you know, the twin Morris, yeah. The twin, you know, and then we're looking at like the Celtics would go on runs where they would just be world beaters. And then they look like absolute trash. And then of course, like the ultimate nail in the coffin was, I think no one talks about this. The Boston Celtics play a certain way. They operate a certain way. When they try to operate like everyone else, it never works out. So when the Boston Celtics tried to play like everybody else, we're going to bring in big name free agents to bring us, get us over the top, like happens with other franchises. We're going to bring in Kyrie Irving, and then we're going to assign Gordon Hayward. None of that worked. When Gordon got injured and Kyrie got injured in 2018, both of those guys were sitting on the bench watching the young guys cook, right? And then when Kyrie comes back and he's up for free agency, you know, first round, they're tearing through people. And the second round, it was just like, how bad can it possibly get?
Yeah, I've never seen it that bad.
You would have to self-sabotage for it to go from what it was in the first round to the second round. And I know no one's going to come out and say that. But, you know, I'll tell you. Kyrie definitely like threw the monkey wrench in the plan of the 2009. He did not want to be there anymore. He did not want that team to go any further. And he'd be damned if he was going to stick around if the Celtics made it to the finals or make it even more awkward. He was gone. He was gone, gone. So the 2020 year, like there was the lost year full of the COVID situation and, you know, a weird.
Still almost make the finals though.
The 2020 year, that's the bubble year. The 2021 season.
That was a disaster.
The 2020 year was really hamstrung by the fact that Gordon Hayward could never be healthy during the postseason. Like, Gordon Hayward was a great, excellent facilitator. Excellent facilitator. He could score, he could rebound, he could pass, and he was a triple threat when he was on the court. But when was he on the court during
We'll always disagree on that one. I want him back. I thought it made a lot of sense. And the biggest reason I thought they were so screwed up in 2021 is because they didn't replace him with anything. Now, was Miles Turner the right way to go? Probably not. But there was a huge gap where Hayward was that whole year. They tried Evan Fournier, which didn't work. And luckily, I was wrong about that one, too. That them not re-signing him was a great move. And then
Evan Fournier is fool's gold.
Mm-hmm.
Because is he an excellent shooter? Sure. What else does he do? What else does he do that helps your team win? Nothing. The difference with Gordon Hayward was versatile.
Yep.
And he was a versatile forward. Again, he rebounds. He passes. He scores. He can hit the three. You have
good defender, too.
Yeah, he's mobile. You have to pay attention when that man's out on the floor. You know, he might draw two people, which makes life easier for the rest of the players on the team, right? His politics notwithstanding, his wife notwithstanding. But he was working when he was on the court and healthy. But when was that? And it was never during the playoffs. And it's the same issue with his career in Charlotte.
Two straight years, same exact time he got hurt each season, right before Charlotte, the playoffs.
Charlotte had a play-in game he couldn't play in. And then when Charlotte has an opportunity to go with the postseason next year, who's not there and injured? Gordon. So that's ultimately comes down to, right? But the Celtics did not replace him. They had nothing for him that season. And again, Jaylen got injured in the playoffs, which is probably, you know, for the best, because what ends up happening is that the Brooklyn series happens, which puts a battery in their back. I'm sure you remember last season, anytime the Celtics played the Brooklyn Nets, it seemed like they were on cruise control. Like, you didn't need to tell them anything. They went at the Nets regardless of who was on the court for them. If they had people missing, they had people playing, whatever. The Celtics were not going to lose to the Brooklyn Nets last year. They were adamant it was going to happen. And I think that the beauty of the Jays is that they are so mature when it comes to anything having to do with Kyrie. That's their man. That's their boy. It wasn't Kyrie's fault. It wasn't Kate's fault. But when they get on the court and they play him and Marcus Smart plays him, it's a different story. They want that man. They want to destroy him.
Remember that little bump in transition Brown gave Kyrie on an and one during that series?
Yes.
Yeah, moments like that.
So moments like that let you know what it really is. So when people talk about like the leadership of the Jays and everything, I'm like, those guys are so focused and so determined, and they're such excellent leaders and so poised for their age. Like, they're both around 25. Like, I always say that we were robbed of seeing Lynn Bias play with Reggie Lewis, because I contend that Reggie Lewis would have been drafted in 1987 with the 22nd or 23rd pick, regardless of what happened, if Lynn Bias was there or not, if the Celtics won the 1987 NBA championship, which they likely would have if Lynn Bias was drafted in 86. They would have repeated. And I guarantee you that between 87 and 93, we would have had Lynn Bias and Reggie Lewis as those two premier wings, both from Baltimore, both around the same size, one with a power game, one with a finesse game, you know, more of a guard type game, you know, both playing on the Boston Celtics in order to transform the NBA as we know it between 87, 88, and 92, 93, right? And we were denied that, you know, due to, you know, Lynn Bias passing away and Reggie Lewis passing away young in 93. But we get it with the Jays. And I think that Boston Celtics fans need to really embrace that and understand, you know, some people have great players in their franchise and had them come up when they were young. We had two of them and we got to see them develop together.
Yeah.
You know, that's a unique situation.
On a winning team too. And that's what the Nets trade allowed them to do, which was really unique. You don't see that much. And maybe you'll see it again with some of these other big trades with a lot of picks coming back, but everything just aligned on that move, the way Pierce and Garnett went out and Brown and Tatum came in within a couple of years. They only had a tank 1 year too, by the way. You look at all these other teams that have had a tank 3-4 straight years.
Okay.
It's crazy.
Can we talk about, people always talk about Danny Ainge and what he did and what he didn't do. Danny Ainge engineered one of the most underappreciated and little talked about 1 year transitions in recent NBA history. The Boston Celtics go to the Eastern Conference Finals in 2017, get destroyed by Cleveland. The Celtics then somehow managed to upgrade every single position.
Yeah.
Every position. And they already were in the finals, you know? And they end up back there with kids. Like, to me, that is, when you think about who was on that roster, and people are nostalgic for that team, which I don't get, because, like, I've never a day in my life been nostalgic for, like, if I go down that roster, if I was to pull up on Basketball Reference and look at that roster, I'd be damned if I'd be nostalgic for that guy center or that
Jonas
guy.
Jonas Jerebko. Yeah. Jay Crowder.
You know,
I get the Isaiah part, though. That was a special time, what he did.
Well, Isaiah was, okay, can we talk about him?
Yeah, let's do it when we get back. Real quick,
yeah.
I want to get in these ads quick, and we got to redo the Zoom here and everything like that. Dome Theory 95 brought to you by Athletic Greens. Go over to athleticgreens.com/garden, and they're going to get you their powder. You throw in your water every morning, get you 75 vitamins, minerals, adaptogens, probiotics, and more. Vitamin D as well, crucial with these cold months ahead. They're going to throw in a year's supply of vitamin D with that deal, as well as 5 free travel packs. The reviews are great, tastes great, gives you that little burst of energy, and again, immune-boosting vitamin D, the key offer there. 5 free travel packs. That's athleticgreens.com/garden. And the Calm app, we've been using that for months here at CLNS Media, and we love it through some of these turbulent times. You guys might need it after the games to get to bed. Meditation, yoga, sleep sounds, bedtime stories, and more. The full library is 40% off when you go to calm.com/garden. That's calm.com/garden, 40% off a premium trial of Calm. We'll be back in just a minute here with Dart Adams. We're going to talk Isaiah for just a minute. I want to get into the Ime Udoka saga here that continues to evolve, as well as his new book, Instead We Became Evil, with Simon. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. Dart, you want to get into Isaiah for just a second there before we hit on Ime?
Real quick. I understand that people have always been, people are nostalgic for the, you know, the IT era, King in the Fourth era. But the thing about Isaiah Thomas was that he played a style of basketball that was an anomaly for the Boston Celtics franchise. He played like Allen Iverson did during his years where he went to the finals. Basically, he was the creator. He was the shot creator. He was the guy who hit all the shots. And you had guys who could hit open threes, and then guys who pretty much were there to rebound to get him the ball back, you know? And, like, everybody, he was the one guy who was the shot creator. Everybody else, like, couldn't create their own shot like IT did. He was also a distributor. So everybody relied on him. And people were used to that kind of basketball around the country. So this is what made them love the Celtics, even though they hated them all the other times, because of the little guy, because of what he did. But here, we knew that he was just a stopgap. And the time that the Boston Celtics saw that there's a window, you know, there's a window for them to be able to move on, and there's a ceiling for where they can go. And when they got to the finals in 2017 and they got killed by Cleveland, they realized there was a ceiling in place. So they jettisoned off everything, and they made an amazing move to take him at the height of his value, even injured. Because they didn't realize how injured he was. Anybody was watching the playoffs to realize he wasn't playing. And they moved that man to bring in Kyrie Irving, the man who killed the Celtics single-handedly in those same playoffs. You know, and so, like, I'm just like, there's this narrative that Ainge doesn't know what he's doing and Ainge is inept. No, Ainge is really good at what he's doing. That's why people didn't want to trade with him. That's why they didn't want to take his calls, because they didn't want to end up the next team on the Summer Jam screen. So that's all I have to say about, like, the IT era.
Yeah, for sure. And Ainge's record, I think, speaks for itself. There were a couple key mistakes along the way, smaller ones, but the bigger plan often, I think, lined up. And you weren't going to be able to pay Isaiah the money he was looking for and build a team around that situation. No. Who knows if he stays healthy or if other guys come. Yeah, like, you had a chance to bring in Durant along the way there, which would have changed things drastically. You had a chance to bring in Hayward next to Thomas, which I think people forget that was kind of the original plan there, and then they shifted to Kyrie. I think guys could have come in front of Isaiah and potentially had a winning situation there, but Hayward gets hurt, Isaiah gets hurt. Injuries every year pretty much seem to be a denying move to the bigger plan with the Celtics. Even last year, who knows what happens if Robert Williams never tears his knee in March. Might be a different story on the outcome of that season. Ime, though, I do want to hit on this again, because there were some developments on the story, not significant ones, more just the gossip stuff, which I'm not as worried about. But we still don't really seem to know the full reason why Ime was suspended here. You know, you got the reports of the consensual relationship. You have the reports of, I guess Woj threw out like crude language was used or something. Again, things don't really seem to add up to a full story that makes sense here yet, which is why this is so difficult to talk about. But we have to, because this guy who was so successful year one, who I loved, by the way, covering, I thought he did a tremendous job as a coach strategically and even with his messaging and emphases, set a lot of the standards for what the Celtics are doing now. It was just this awesome hire, and a guy who seemingly was overdue for his opportunity gets this golden opportunity with a great roster to potentially win a championship, and they lose the finals. He has that parting message of coming back better, and it looks like that he'll never get to hold up his end of that, which is crazy, unfortunate, tragic in a way, I guess. But again, we don't know what he did. I don't know what his future holds. They suspend him for 1 year. They don't fire him, which I think is kind of strange in itself, but there's also probably a lot of legal stuff going on behind the scenes there that has to get sorted out. It's been messy. I think people were confused at first why the Celtics did it, though you would think if they self-imposed a one-year suspension on their own head coach a week before the season in really unprecedented fashion, in a way that could derail a potentially championship season, something serious had to be going on, I would imagine. And maybe we'll figure it out eventually. Maybe we won't. Maybe he'll coach again somewhere else. I think one of the key points in the latest Woj report was that he might be able to go and coach somewhere else if someone's interested in that. But how does another team figure out what was actually going on here if we're not able to, and no one really seems to be able to? Again, much of the organization seemed caught off guard by this. It was a very recent development, the investigation and everything that followed. And I think people are upset about the woman that got thrown into this through all the speculation. That day or so where this report was just floating out there and nothing really got followed up on. And then, of course, still not many details since. And I get it. The team's hands are tied. But this is just a controversial decision and a really messy, awkward one that I think a lot of people want answers on. And we just don't have any. So we're just kind of left here saying, all right, I guess Ime's not the coach anymore. Joe Mazzulla is taking over, and that's going to be the plan in the future. Just the weirdest story I've ever seen.
The problem is that there's so many other like moving pieces that make this even more complicated than it is. One, the Boston Celtics pride themselves in being a top flight organization, above reproach. The Boston Celtics do not want to be seen like the majority of sports franchises that are currently operating, being that they're going into their 76th season and they're a marquee franchise. The Boston Celtics have the most NBA championships in league history. They have the most Hall of Famers in league history. You know, a lot of firsts can be attributed to the Boston Celtics franchise. They want to be here, elite, top tier. And when you have a scandal of this nature happen, the Boston Celtics want this nipped at the bud, want it to be known. We're going to handle this internally. We don't want anything to get out. This is something we don't stand for. No. And we're not. 1 year, gone. Suspended. Bam, immediately. He did X, Y, and Z. We're handling it. It's done. Problem is that when that information got out, it was reported by Woj at close to midnight in a very vague fashion, right?
Yep.
That lent you to like, wait, there's more to this. This is very vague, Woj. Like, why aren't you saying more? And as you know, there's a war between Woj and Shams, you know, try to get the upper hand, try to one-up each other. So Shams comes back and is like, actually, here's some more details. And the way it's reported when Shams does it, midnight going forward. Now, it's midnight on the East Coast, but that means that it's 9:10 on the West Coast. And now this means that this is the biggest story on real-time social media. And everybody turns into Sherlock damn Holmes to try to dig. And the Boston Celtics are not making a statement because the Boston Celtics didn't make this statement. It leaked. I don't think that this is how the Boston Celtics wanted this to get out, because what ends up happening is a whole bunch of women that work in the Boston Celtics organization and in the periphery ended up in harm's way.
Yeah.
Because people don't care. And why don't they care? Because here's the other string. The other string that's unfortunate. Ime Udoka's partner is Nia Long, who is a famous actress, well-regarded, legendary, beloved by people that don't even give a damn about Boston Celtics basketball. Matter of fact, there's a lot of people that only cared about what the Boston Celtics were doing because Ime Udoka was Nia Long's partner. There are articles written about I'm rooting for the Boston Celtics because Ime Udoka is Nia Long's partner, which blew my mind. Now, that level makes it so that there's, oh, he dropped the bag with Nia and all this other stuff. So now everybody who reads the gossip sites, you know, the gossip IGs, and, you know, goes through the gossip threads on Twitter, now they're involved in this investigation. People won't even give a damn about sports. So the reporters are huddled up in threads and text chains, I'm sure you were aware, going back and forth about, oh, this is bad, because it's this woman, they don't want to give her identity. She's memory, you know, there's kids involved, you know, the guys in the Boston Celtics organization. So now everybody's going on every website to figure out who is the person, who is the woman, and they're going through old footage of press conferences, post games.
Oh my God, my old tweets, the photos and yeah, little cuts or whatever. Like yes. It was just all popping up.
People were doing screenshots. It's her. It's her. See, that's her hair color. This is her in the other angle. And I'm just like, all this happened in hours. So by the time the morning comes, I'm in four different text group chats with people asking me questions and feeding information. And journalists just like, there's no better word for it. This is a shit show. And they're like, the Celtics need to make a statement. What can they say now? You know, this has been taken out of their hands. But I feel that if we're going to talk about Ime, strictly Ime, this is his fault. Ime Udoka is a grown-ass man. He's an adult. He should have known about the repercussions of his own actions, especially you can't not know what kind of organization the Boston Celtics are. You've known that these type of scandals have happened on other teams, in other leagues, and there's a whole league that's going through issues now with these types of things. You know, there's a whole scandal on Twitch, you know, involving this. You have to have the awareness to know that I hate using this term, but it's the term that any Gen Xer knows who grew up watching mob movies. You don't shit where you eat, right? But also the other part is that you know not to do this.
Yeah, and he's nothing in such a high good. Position too.
In that position, the power dynamic, nothing good was going to come from this. You have one of the most prestigious jobs in sports. In sports. That spans the globe. You have one of the most prestigious jobs in sports. You almost won an NBA championship your first year. Think about all these players, all these jobs, all these lives that you affect with your actions. And God forbid this would have come out during the season. God forbid this come out during the playoff run.
Yeah.
God forbid this came out at any other time. And the Boston Celtics thought that they were being proactive and saying, no, we're handling this now. However, that's not where it stops because people want answers. And even now, people want answers. But the problem is this involves real people with real lives. And it affects children and all these other and every other thing. Like, you know, so the Celtics don't want to do the harm that Ime Udoka already did or compounded. But everybody wants answers. And now you go to Daily Mail, you know, posting up stuff that people were talking about, what, weeks ago? In threads and weeks ago on Twitter, and they think it's reporting. And that's been a big issue with this. There have been a bunch of people in the media who are journalists who forgot that they're journalists and forgot there are tenets of journalism and forgot there's a process to this and jumped to their conclusion. Why? Because if you go on ESPN, if you go on other sports sites or any sports radio, it's not really about having information and having all the information. It's about reaction.
or a piece of it, right? Because that sort of goes back to the Woj Shams thing. Woj has that there's a suspension. Shams has that the nature of it. And then everything is released through one bit of information instead of the whole story, which is sort of how it should be handled. Especially as you said, this isn't a trade. This isn't a transaction or a rumor. This is people's lives and really serious accusations being made. You have to have the full story, I think, to be doing this right. But instead, there's a reward and an incentive structure to just having a piece of it. If you have a small tidbit of the story, people want to hear it. Publications want to run it, and they will.
I mean, the worst part is that, like, if you're talking about real-time social media, jokes are more important than facts. That's why, like, people ask me, like, how come you haven't come out and said anything and done this and this? It was like, because I'm a journalist and I operate on facts. And I operate from a position of knowing enough information to be able to make a statement and say something. And that's why, like, the thing I was saying about what Kyrie did in 2019, it's 2022 going into 2023. Enough time has passed, and I've seen enough to arrive at what I just said, even though no one else has come out and said it. You know, like, I'm not going to come out and say something or do something without having a sufficient amount of information or data there to support something I said. So a lot of times, man, it's sad to see in the sports realm too, because a lot of it is turned into, you know, conjecture and just, you know, not sports. You know, it's not exactly sports. We're not even talking about the sports. We're talking about, like, something related to basketball as opposed to basketball, you know. And a lot of times people make comparisons, and the people making the comparisons don't have the knowledge base to go deep enough to make a comparison that's even worthy of putting on camera, you know, or writing about. But they do it anyway because people are watching or people are reading. And it's frustrating as hell to me, man.
I think, you know, this one especially, you just saw how poorly the sports media was equipped to cover something like that. Whether it was the scoop reporters or the information people, whether it was that fast take reaction, real-time reaction programming. Because again, in the early days, we had little to no information about this. So how are you going to go on TV and fill a 15-minute segment giving your take on this? I think people probably said some things that they regret, not only about the Celtics, which... You know, I was probably a little tough on the Celtics in the early going too, in terms of how they handled this. And then you look back and you're like, all right, it's a little more understandable why they did what they did. But even on Ime's front, I mean, of course, you know, to throw one name out there, Stephen A. Smith comes out hard in his defense. You know, there was talk of the racial component to this, and maybe that's there. But again, we don't know. We don't have the facts on it. We don't have the comparisons. I asked at the press conference, was this handled evenly with situations like this in the past? Mm-hmm. I didn't get a great answer, but, you know, I asked the question and that was that. And again, you know, it's hard to make a definitive statement on how everyone handled this. It's hard for me to even make a definitive statement on Ime and his future and what he deserves here. And
you can't make a definitive statement because there's no definitive statement to make. The man hasn't been fired yet.
Yep.
You know, and the reason is because of dangling things that have to do with, you know, contracts and legalese and the other people involved and all the stuff that they're still holding on to in terms of information, right? And we got to play the season. You know, I really feel that this season will determine everything, because ultimately everybody's looking at Joe Mazzulla to see what kind of job he's going to do as a first year coach. You know, like, Ime Udoka came from the pop tree, right? In terms of
great
coaching.
Experience, yep. Finals, great experience. Stars, yeah.
Work with Team US, run with USA Basketball.
Had relationships with these players that went back. Like, it was a perfect storm, it felt like.
Yeah, like, he was the perfect hire. And also, he was, you know, the Boston Celtics hired another young Black coach, you know, who looked like he was going to bring them to the promised land. And, you know, Ime Udoka had the perfect situation, and he blew it. He blew it. And now what has to happen is Boston Celtics, which are a much more resilient organization and group than anybody gives them credit for and now going to show everybody that they are. There were fans that said that they thought that because, you know, Ime wasn't coaching anymore, that kind of blew the Celtics' chance of going to the finals. And I'm like, I've seen the Celtics go to the finals when they lost both of their stars. You know, I've seen Celtics go to the Eastern Conference finals, you know, when they didn't have a healthy guy who they got free agency a few years before. It's like, I've seen the Boston Celtics overcome so much in recent years and come back from so much. Like, think about what happened to them when Kyrie stepped on the logo and pretty much kind of felt like he buried the franchise. That team came back the next year and went and were two games from winning the NBA championship. So please, if you're a supposed Celtics fan with any type of short-term memory, please know that this team is not the team that's going to roll over and die for any purpose. And they already, if you thought that they had a revenge tour last year, after what happened in the finals, you think that they're not super focused on winning it all this year, regardless of what happens after what you've seen the first two games in the preseason? Get the hell out of here.
We're going to talk about Dart's book, Instead We Became Evil, A True Story of Survival and Perseverance. The story of Simon, who I was not familiar with, a Danish by way of Palestine rapper, recording artist who, of course, came through gang life in Denmark, which I also was not familiar with. I guess the one thing I'll say right off the bat is the amount of blood, the amount of violence, the amount of trauma in this book. I mean, from the opening scene, you have him getting shot, and just like his whole experience of going through that and how he reacted to it and what he said and why he did it. Early in his life, his dad stabs his mom and his sister, and all of them nearly die, and his dad goes to jail. And then, of course, you have him and his friend have a falling out where he ends up stabbing his friend and going to jail. And just the amount of crime, the amount of, miscommunications between different people on different sides of all this. He was going through a lot in his early life. And it hit me because, again, I'm halfway through this book. He goes to jail. He had already done this, that, that, and this. Robberies, fights, beatings, this and that, everything you can think of crime wise, he had done it. And he goes to jail. And this is the first time, maybe I missed it earlier in the book, but when he goes to jail, you find out he's 17.
Yeah.
And already been through all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
the why Simon? This is, I think you had kind of posed this question in talking about this book before, but why was this guy's story important to tell?
So the thing about Sleeman is he's been famous since he was a young teenager in Europe. He started getting arrested early because, you know, when you're an immigrant and you don't speak the language and you come over and they don't know what to do for you, you know, in a mostly white country. So when Sleeman first came to Denmark, his family eventually were moved into a housing development that was across the river from another housing development, which was overwhelmingly populated by Arab immigrants, people who fled, you know, war-torn countries, and they're in Denmark, in Europe. So what happens is you have a whole generation of young kids who have this culture at home, and that culture is completely different from the world of the street. And in Denmark, there are all these racist skinhead biker gangs. So you're pretty much food on these streets. And when you enter the public school system, you know, you got to play catch up because you don't speak the language, you know, so people treat you like you're stupid. So that already, you know, starts the jail, the school to prison pipeline, you know, overseas. And then these kids fall into gang life because they all have to click up because they have to protect themselves from all these dangers outside. And also they have similar home lives where, you know, they come from Arab backgrounds and they're Muslims. Some of them are strict. Some of them are less strict at home, but they don't understand what their kids are doing when they leave the house. And a lot of times if they get in trouble at school and a person from school shows up at their home and tells the parent that the kid did X, Y in school, they go to the extremes to discipline them. because they don't, there's no, you know, in between. Plus, they don't fully understand what the people are saying because they don't speak the language. And they're having a hard time because let's say they had jobs and they had positions overseas back home before they left. And now they have to do like day work and do like, you know, menial labor, you know, that degrades them because they don't speak the language or their schooling doesn't matter here, you know? So the parents are in this bad situation. The kids are in this bad situation. And Sleeman was one of these kids, you know, that was in that situation. And as the boy in the family of women, he often had to be the protector, but he also ended up protector for other people. And he also ended up the mouthpiece a lot. So from a very young age, he's going to town halls. He's going to meetings. He's being identified by police as the leader of gangs and stuff like that. So it sends his life on this interesting trajectory because he wants to be the hero. He wants to be the guy who protects everybody and speaks up for everybody and puts himself on the front line all the time, but it's not reciprocated. So he's the one that receives all of the, you know, the repercussions. That's why he's been to jail all these times. And when he did all these up in the paper in Denmark, in Europe, he was written, there are hundreds of articles written about this man before he even turned the age of 18. Hundreds. It's insane. Like, he was famous for being a gangster. So when he already, so when he became a legitimate artist and turned his life around, it was a whole nother thing because people looked at him being an Arab immigrant, what have you. They thought he could never achieve certain things. They thought he'd never be this person. They thought he'd never, you know, be somebody respected. And now if you go on YouTube and type in Sleeman, you're going to see a bunch of videos with millions of views. And if you looked on DSPs, he had millions upon millions of listens, you know, and he's the most famous Dutch speaking rapper, you know, in the world as an Arab immigrant who can't even leave because he can't have a passport. And also because he went to jail early in Denmark, he can never be a citizen, you know? So he's a stateless Palestinian who came from Lebanon where his family couldn't be citizens and then came to Europe, to Denmark, where he can't be a citizen, but he's probably one of the most famous people in the country. It's an insane story. And I just had to be involved. I was writing another book. I was sent this by my editor, I mean, by my own publisher. He was like, could you look at this 115,000 word manuscript translated from Danish into English, which means I had no contractions, cannot, can't, cannot, will not, a whole lot of idioms that didn't translate well to English. And I said, I have to be involved in this. And it was an 18-month process from when I started talking to Sleeman on WhatsApp and taking notes and going back and forth. This book was such an undertaking. One thing everybody needs to understand about this book, why it was such an undertaking, there's no statute of limitations in Denmark. What that means is now if you write a book or make a film in America, if you were a gangster, if you did some illegal activity in 1979 and you make a film about it in 2005, you can't be brought up on charges for things that happened in that movie. And the people who are identified or given another name to protect them or whatever, they can't be brought up on charges. In Denmark, you can. So when the book was originally released in Denmark in 2012, they had to go through all these legal hoops and jump through all these wires. And there are a lot of disembodied voices. Somebody will say, someone said, drop the knife. Someone said, do this. That reason is because even if I print this book in 2022 in America, someone in Denmark can read that book. And if I identified somebody as saying something that could be brought up, have them brought up on charges 20, 25 years after the fact, they will be. So that was a unique thing that was presented in making this book. It's a process that I doubt, like a first time, you know, person trying to do a memoir. You know, there's a lot of things that like, I think I did that prepared me for my future writing books going forward.
Yeah, so you said it started as a book from 2012 in yes. Denmark. You had a manuscript. It was in a different language. So what was kind of the starting point? You said you talked to him. Was this more translation? Was this more reporting on your end? Like, what kind of went into creating kind of like a whole new English version book out of what was already there?
it had a lot to do with framing, right? Because there are a lot of concepts and things that translate well to American, North American life, growing up in the inner city especially. But in Danish, the idiom doesn't make sense. Like we would sit there on WhatsApp and we would talk about like, I was living a double life. But the phrase that we use in this is double akasitis, you know, the double-faced man, essentially. And I'm like, oh, no, that's not going to work. It's not going to work. So, like, we would just, like, break things down like that. And then there were things like, all right, so since this book's come out, your mom passed away. You couldn't say what her name was in the book because she was still alive. She was still living in the housing development. Can we say what your sister's names are now? So it's like, yes, we can identify my sisters now. So it was things like that. And then him sharing personal things in his life, you know. So I was trusted with this man's life. He's living. He's living. He's younger than me, you know. He's living and breathing, you know. And like, I read some of these chapters. One chapter in particular, only the seagulls cried back. I was like, yo, your sister is a superhero. Like, there's no way I'm going to fail you. And telling your family's life story. I mean, it's telling your family story, man. And people need to hear this because the MENA community here, the representation in terms of books, they fall into two categories, refugees or survival, you know? And thank God that after a while, the book went out of on Amazon, the refugee and survival section, and went into rap and hip hop biographies, which is always my dream for it, because this book to me falls more in line with, you know, the Rick Ross book, the Gucci Mane book, you know, the book about who passed away, Nipsey Hussle. Yep. To me, this book is more aligned with their lives than anything else. But due to the fact that he's a Palestinian and he's from overseas, it's going to end up the refugee story, you know? And I'm like, no, this story needs to be right on the same shelf as those other ones I mentioned, which were published by my friends, you know? So that was kind of what I really wanted to get across. And, you know, it's been received well, you know, it's been out for, it's almost October 9th, so September, 2 months. So the book's been out for about 2 months. It's doing well, you know, it's gaining a name. I did a book, event for it at Frugal Bookstore not too long ago, you know. So hopefully it leads to more stories, more diverse stories for the MENA community.
Sure. Yeah, you wouldn't imagine a story like this. And that is where I found in Barnes & Noble is the music, you know, hip-hop biography section. So that works out. As far as like the sequencing of the book goes too, I love that. I don't know how much like that went into how much your input and your construction of it went into that, but kind of opening with that scene, him getting shot, not really knowing why or what or when, and then kind of going into his early life and just had the little moments where it seemed like he might get it right. Whether it was when they took him to, I think it was Norway. And he ends up doing that camp with those two guys. And like, he's getting in this great shape and, you know, he seems to be really getting his life together. And then he gets taken back by someone who, you know, spoke to his mother, whatever it was. And,
yeah,
you know, ended up having that program.
The wild thing is that.
Go ahead.
The wild thing is that he was stolen from his home as a child, as a teenager, and taken to another country without his family's knowledge. That's how much of a problem they thought this man was. Now, he wasn't even a man yet, you know? So that's, when I read that chapter, and he sent me pictures, he's like, this was me in camp in Norway. These were my dogs, my sled dogs, and all this other. I was like, they stole you and brought you to another country without your family's knowledge. Who can say that? And when he came back home, when he came back, he had no place to stay because they wouldn't allow him to stay with his family in a shelter. So he was homeless when he came back. Who has a life story like that?
Yeah. And then even after going to jail, it looked like he was getting his life right. And just like the whispers of the streets and everything like that just kind of pulled him back in, and different people who were influencing him and using him for their own whims. It is kind of crazy just how much like crossover he had with so many different people and like how that just kind of had him like whipping in the wind. But what ultimately brought him to music?
He always loved music, but the thing was, and this is hilarious, the way he explains it is that being in the gang culture and, you know, in a, of an Arab background, they didn't want him being a musician and making music because they thought that was soft, you know, and they thought that you're going to do something creative. Now you better get over here and make us money. You know, you better extort people. You know, you better, you know, beat some people up and get some money out of them. You know, you better rob somebody, you know, like, cause they relied on him to be the guy, you know, everybody made money on Sweeney's back. You know, he was like the guy. So if he was going to leave that, do something creative, there was a lot that all those folks were going to lose. And also they thought it was kind of soft. Whereas stateside, if you're a gangster, you want to get into the entertainment rap world, you know, the music world, you know, because that helps you out in that sphere. Whereas in Denmark, him being a gangster and a reputed criminal was hurting him trying to break into the music world. So he had to prove himself as a legitimate musician, you know, over time, breaking in with different groups and making songs and stuff like that until he figured out his sound, you know? And when he figured out his sound, that's when he started making hits. And if you go on YouTube and type in Sleeman, you're going to notice there's a type of style, a type of song that he does that has millions and millions of views. He figured out his style and, you know, he ended up like just being like a hit maker and he ended up getting record deals and getting a label deal and stuff like that. But he'd always been in love with like rap. He was a hip hop dancer, you know, he'd go to hip hop concerts, but then like he got pulled out of it by people in the street life. Like, no, you can't do that, man. You got to get out here and help make us money.
When did you become aware of him?
I knew of him through, I knew people in the Netherlands. There's this hip hop site called Movement that always covered beat culture and rap globally. And they talked about like the beat culture in Amsterdam, but also I learned about like rap over there in the Netherlands and Denmark and, you know, in the Danish speaking countries, like all that stuff right there. And they're all connected, you know, even though everybody speaks different languages in Europe, it's really interesting that way. And so I learned about him back when he was in a Caliber. The group he was working with, Caliber, started making noise like 2013, 14, 15, and he was involved with them. So that's when I first like knew his name, but I didn't know of him to the extent that I did when I got that manuscript back in 2019, I believe, going into 2020. Yeah.
Well, it's out now in English. Instead, We Became Evil, Sleeman's Story, along with Dart Adams. Of course, you can find Dart in a million different publications and on Twitter all times of day and night at Dart_Adams. We'll be talking preseason tonight as we record this in just a couple hours here. Celtics Hornets getting underway. I always enjoy chatting Celtics with you as well as your journalistic work at Dart. And thanks as always for your support of our coverage here. We really appreciate it. You've been one of our big supporters.
Hey, no doubt.
All right. That's Dome Theory 95. We'll be back next week. Some more interviews as the Celtics preseason continues here. And we get another regular season in just a few more weeks. Check us out, CLNS Media, Celtics All Access. Of course, show some love to our sponsors as well, athleticgreens.com/garden and calm.com/garden. We'll talk to you soon.